Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. I have had the pleasure of talking to some of the leading authors, artists, activists, and change makers of our time on this podcast. And I want to personally thank you for subscribing, listening, and sharing 100 plus episodes over 100,000 times. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy. And I look forward to more conversations with those important voices that will bring clarity to the situation we find ourselves in as we move toward November of 2024. If you appreciate these conversations and my cultural and political commentary, please subscribe to this podcast, In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, on your favorite platform, and to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. I'd really appreciate the help. Thank you.
I think there's a backlash to a lot of, you know, but you know, it's just like everybody's, oh, Taylor Swift and her breakup songs. Well, hello, what have pop songs ever been about if not breakups and heartbreak? When the Beatles were writing songs about heartbreak and all, nobody said, oh, they just date women so they have fodder for their next hit. You know, this is the stuff that people say about Taylor Swift. It's ridiculous.
So anyway, Candy, my wife Jeannie said, make sure you tell Candy that, as I told you, I think before, that she loves your book. She has bought and given away 5 copies.
Oh, wow. That's
so
very...
it's getting personal now. This is costing me. Us. I mean, we have a joint account. We've been together forever. So when she says she's given away 5 of your books, that's we've given away 5 of your books. But she's recommended it to everybody. And people, you know, she cares about, like my daughter Jessica has read it. Both her sisters and her Jeannie's sisters, who are in the same age bracket as us, or she, have read it. And she talks about it all the time. So it's great. I mean, it made a huge impression on Jeannie.
That's very nice to hear. That's music to an author's ears.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just really, really nice to know.
It has legs, and I'm going to introduce you properly, but I just wanted to make sure that, you know, Jeannie got to say hi to you via me and tell you that she just thinks it's a terrific book. And also, you know, we both think of your history of the Beatles as a kind of a lens through which to look at a far bigger picture, and you do it so well. I mean, really captures the time and the kind of change that came about in America, but all over the world during the Beatles era, irrespective of just them. I mean, it's a real thing, you know. So, hey, passing it on.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
That's what I set out to do was to tell the story of the Beatles, but it really through a much wider lens than that.
So. Plus, you're a good writer. That helps.
Thank you.
And you know your stuff and you live through it. So you've got, you know, all the things that should happen. A book should be about something you know. It should be about a lived experience, and it should be well written. And your book on the Beatles, which I guess has now been out 10 years.
It's 10 years. I like to think of it as not old, but a classic.
Yeah. Well, is that us or the book?
Both.
Both of us. Yeah. And the book. Hey, let me introduce you properly. This is In Conversation with Frank Schaefer. I am Frank Schaefer. This is my podcast. And it goes where podcasts go. It's also a live event on YouTube and some other places. And this marks the 10th anniversary of the publication of Candy Leonard's excellent book. Candy Leonard is my guest, called Beatleness: How the Beatles and Their Fans Remade the World. And this is an unusual podcast because I don't usually interview authors of a book twice about the same book. And we will talk about other things. We had Candy on before, but as I was saying to Candy a minute ago when we were just chatting, this has become one of my wife Jeannie's favorite books and mine as well. Jeannie's bought and given away 5 copies. And to friends and as well as her sisters. So I wanted to talk about the book a little more. And also, you know, you're such a good observer of culture and history and where we are. I wanted to get a little bit into the whole boomer thing today.
Mm-hmm.
And the complaints against the boomers, of which we are representative to people of that generation, and the Beatle thing and so on. So let me just start, excuse me, by saying, Is there anything you'd like to tell us about the book in terms of this being the 10th anniversary and the kind of impact it's had on people like my wife, Jeannie? One footnote, and then I will be quiet. I got a note from somebody the other day saying, talk less, let your guests talk more, but I still have to set it up. So, and then I'll talk less. Jeannie and I met the week after Abbey Road was released because she was in Europe on a Eurail pass, having graduated from high school. And she came to my parents' ministry called Labrie Fellowship, which was an evangelical ministry in Europe. And she asked me, do you happen to have the new Beatles album or have you heard it yet? Because I've been on the road and it's the only album that I don't have of theirs that I haven't bought on the day it came out. So I said, I happen to have that album downstairs. And we went down and listened to Abbey Road. And that's how I met my wife. And we've been together for the last 54 years. So your book, Beatleness, speaks to both of us in a very personal way, too, because we met, literally met, because of the Beatles. Okay, enough said. What's the book done for the last 10 years and how are you?
I'm good. I'm always happy to talk about the Beatles and my book. It's interesting, you know, you talk about how the Beatles played this personal and very special role in your life. And that's true for millions of people of our generation.
Yeah.
And I, you know, that's part of what I tried to capture in the book. But, you know, the idea that you met your wife through it, I mean, so many people have had experiences like that. And, you know, the book came out 10 years ago for the 50th anniversary. And over the last 10 years, I mean, I've sort of stopped, you know, going out on the road and doing promotions and stuff. But I, you know, I still write now and then and do, you know, opportunities like this, which I really appreciate. But I get email from people, you know, saying, oh, I just discovered your book. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the same thing that you're saying is like, it's like you follow, people say it's like you follow, it's like you followed me around with a video camera when I was a teenager, you know, because what I wanted to do was capture the experience of what it was like to grow up with the Beatles as a constant presence in your life for 6 years, at least the US experience was 6 years. And, you know, the media environment was very different then. You know, there were three channels, there were, you know, one or two radio stations in each market. So, you know, they were, but even with that small media, few channels, they were everywhere. They were ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to communicate, you know, like what I set out to do was to communicate what that was like, you know, like, particularly now, you know, the during the height of Beatlemania, let's say it was 64 to 66 was like the super peak. It was, you know, they were like, you know, like some fans that I interviewed said it was like, you know, they were like another sibling in the house, like another presence in the household. They were, you listened to them all the time and they, you talked about them and connected with friends or like you're saying with future partners and spouses. Mm-hmm. And they were the background to our, well, even not even background, in some cases, background and foreground for boomers when we were growing up. I mean, they were the quintessential boomer experience and focal point because even if you were not particularly didn't identify as a huge Beatle fan, you were still aware of them. And they had such an impact on the culture that you were impacted by them, whether you knew it or not.
Yeah.
And, you know, when people say, you know, how do you define baby boomer? You know, there's the demographers define it as being born between 1946 and 1964. But what I would define it as sort of a more cultural definition is anybody with a living memory of the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. That was the boomer experience. You
and
know?
That's a, what is it, 60 years ago? Aren't we at an Ed Sullivan anniversary as well? He had
we
them on
just passed February, a couple of months ago, we passed the 60th. But this week, actually, this early April marks the 60th anniversary of when the Beatles occupied the top five slots on the Billboard charts. Now, other artists have since met that record, surpassed that statistic. But but again, remember at the time that we didn't have all these channels like we have now. The
Right.
environment was much smaller and tamer, and so you were exposed to them, even if you didn't like them, you
Yeah.
were exposed to them. So if you think about those five songs in the top five slots on top 40 radio, okay, I call it the echo chamber,
Yeah.
because they were rising to the top five slots. You heard them constantly, and then they were, for however many weeks they were on, and then as they were coming down the charts, so the very air we breathed was
Yeah.
infused with their sound. And those particular five songs, as many of the early hits were, they were short, they were, these little bursts of energy with, and they were, with hooks that, so you knew the words after hearing it a few times. It really seeped into young people's brains, and people's
Do you remember the name of the five songs? Because
like,
I don't.
I should, it's please, please, actually, I have it. It's Please Please Me, I Want to Hold Your Hand, She Loves You. Oh my goodness, how could I not know this off the
Well, those
top
were the three I would have thought of, but
head? Echo Chamber, just a second.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot here.
It's, I am gonna lose my cred that I don't know off the top of my head. I should have had this, I should have known this. It's, the early hits, I Want to Hold Your Hand, of Beatles' Echo Chamber.
And Ernie says, my producer says, it's Can't Buy Me Love, Twist and Shout. She loves you.
Right.
I want to
Can't Buy
hold your
Me Love, I
hand.
Want to Hold
Please
Your Hand,
please me.
Excuse Me, She Loves You, and Twist and Shout. Right. The Echo
Yeah.
Chamber. Now, Can't Buy Me Love was also, of course, in A Hard Day's Night, and we're
Yeah.
coming up on this, the summer will be, that movie will be 60 years old, which is
Yeah.
kind of, but these songs, if you think about them, I mean, they're like under 3 minutes, and
Yeah.
each one is, with this repetitive hook, and this, you they you know and fans say, like, I was hardwired for joy with the Beatles, or the Beatles are like deep in my brain, like, that's, it was a very powerful thing, hearing these songs over and over and over again, and it became, like, it was just a joyous thing, this for young people to have these, this music that was ours. It wasn't our parents' music. It was
Yeah.
obviously by these young, made by and for young people. They were doing their own thing. They were writing their songs, which was unheard, very
Sure.
unusual at that time. And unlike with Elvis, like, okay, there were four of them, so
Yeah.
like you could pick a favorite, which was like a huge part of the fan experience. Who's
Yeah.
your favorite? People still ask me this to this day. So it was kind of like a wraparound experience, even from the get-go, from those very, very early days. And then through the decade, because they sold newspapers, and so the press covered their every move, right?
Yeah.
There were constantly articles about them. So, young fans became newspaper readers because they were like scouring the newspaper for articles about the Beatles. And the other interesting thing in terms of sort of this fan experience and reading about them is that when they would go on tour in other places outside the US, we knew about that also. So there
Sure.
was a sense of that we were, this was not only happening in my family, in my neighborhood, in my school, my community, it was happening all over the world. And I think that this contributed to this sort of global consciousness and
Yeah.
this sense of like young people being part of something big.
Bigger, yeah. You know, it's interesting because you obviously were in the States experiencing the Beatles. I was in a British boys' boarding school,
Right.
and my exposure to the Beatles was there. And I'm 72 in August, do all those dates. So basically, I was 10, 11, 12 during that point of their careers. And of course, you know, the experience of the Beatles in the UK was just as intense as here
Right.
and a little bit earlier. But it brings up an interesting point because we kept track of where they were, just like you did. And so all of a sudden, you know, America was on the map for us because the Beatles had gone over there and conquered the American audience. And just going back to a point you brought up that dovetails with a lot of things. Oh, and by the way, before I forget, and then I'll go back to this point, we're making your book on Beatleness part of our book club for this month, for the month of April. So
Yeah.
we have a little book club called It Has to Be Read. I have a thing I do called It Has to Be Said. We do It Has to Be Read, and the title for the month of April is Beatleness, is your book.
Well, thank you so
It'll
much.
be the anniversary. So yeah, it's part of our book club as well and available, and people can link to it. But you know, I think it's hard for people who are of a younger generation than us to understand how the gatekeepers were absolutely monolithic in those days. There were three TV state channels in the US. There were two in Great Britain. The BBC was one, and ITV was the other. There were no other choices. There was nothing online. There was no social media. Nobody did anything like we're doing here. You were either on the big time media or you didn't exist. Newspapers were the form of communication. But, you know, today, if you look at the superstars like Taylor Swift, she still appeals to the sliver of people that follow her, and she's universally known. But the Swifties are in touch with each other in their own media. They're following her and so forth. When the Beatles were big, everybody was aware of them. It wasn't a sliver of the population because everyone was getting their news feeds from the same three networks
Right.
and the same newspapers, and the whole media was covering them. There wasn't a sliver of Beatle influence. It was the entire culture. And it wasn't just the entire culture in the US. It was also in the UK and in Germany and all over the world in a
Right.
way that today's generation can't imagine because it's so disparate and spread out. Everybody has their own little thing. I just want some of your thoughts on that. Just this kind of unanimity of covering that people don't get anymore.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you bring up Taylor Swift because one of the things that I always talk about, I think I s said it earlier, is how the Beatles were this constant presence in our lives through 6 years of, important years of child and adolescent development. Like I was seven when the Beatles came along. You were a few years older, even like college students, older teenagers were into them. So they affected this huge swath of the population for 7 years, 7 critical years of development. Taylor Swift has been around for, she's been making music and, chart topping music for, what is it now? I don't know, over 10 years anyway. And so she's had an enormous influence, I talk about how fans would sit in the room listening to the lyrics, gazing at the album covers, listening to these words and the poetry. She's been doing that for a really long time. And, and she is also a global star, and she's hugely talented. I mean, she's
I think so too.
the brilliant lyricist, but her fandom, when you think about the profound influence, like let's put it this way, anybody who's been following Taylor Swift from her beginning to now, I mean, that's a huge impact. And so it actually makes the Beatles, the 6 years, seem in some sense less consequential. But that we get back to the scale of it because, the everybody was following the Beatles. You couldn't sort of not be aware of
Yeah,
and.
exactly. And every other band was defined by them. You know, I very much enjoy Taylor Swift's presence in the world, but I don't hear people comparing everything else they listen to her.
Right. No.
Whereas if you were a Stones fan or the Kinks or later on the Grateful Dead, you know, you were always listening for things that came from the Beatles and or it was an opposition to the Beatles, and or you liked your band better than the Beatles, but there was no way not to make that reference.
Right, because they were innovative. I mean, Taylor Swift is brilliant, but she's doing very good pop music, but it's not innovative. It's not a new sound in the way that the Beatles were. And also, it's the moment in time when the Beatles appeared was kind of ripe for them to have the impact that they had. But yes, I mean, all other music was compared to them because they established a new standard,
Well, not only
including
that, all other
writing their own
politics was
stuff.
compared to them. If
What?
people were all other politics and social trends were compared to them, they were part of a political movement that reshaped the world. And it wasn't just sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was that too, but it was an entire language. You know, my haircut at school was defined by the Beatles.
That's right.
And
Yeah,
if it
yeah.
was, if you were in a conservative thing, then you had to get a haircut so you wouldn't look like the Beatles. And you know, when the hippies came along, that was a Beatles phenomena. I don't think people these days get, I mean, their impact was musical, but it was cultural, and it was a phenomenon that I've never seen another band or artist or movie star or television star or program or anything else repeat, because it didn't, you
Yes.
know, a
Yes.
whole generation turned on this.
Yeah, the moment was the historical moment was different. The economy was different. The technology, the poli everything was different. But yeah, it. But you know, you mentioned about the hair. This is another thing that you know younger people like find hard to sort of like. Why was their
Sure.
hair such a big deal? You know, and it as of course we know that it was, but you know, and it was seen as very threatening. You know,
Yeah.
so. People say, oh, the Beatles didn't get political until, you know, the song Revolution. I disagree.
Yeah, I
I would
agree.
say
Yeah.
they were political from the get-go
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
even back to the press conference at Kennedy Airport when they first got here, they took a they were audacious. They you know, bantered with the press in a very confident, empowered sort of way. They had that they looked like people we'd never seen before. And so they empowered young people in a
Yeah.
really profound way. And the hair became a focal point of that.
Yeah.
And like you say, I mean, within weeks, you start to see articles in the paper about, you know, kids getting suspended from school for having their hair long or you know, conflicts with parents about, you know,
Well,
boys.
or getting beaten up by today's equivalent of,
Right.
you know, right-wing MAGA people. I mean, that element was against the Beatles from the beginning, which bring Ernie sent me this, and I want, this is exactly where we're going, so I'm going to ask you this. And he's saying, were the boomers the first generation allowed to be young in the sense that the Beatles made youth culture powerful? You used the word power a minute, and it certainly was very different than, say, what Elvis was doing.
I mean, I think, you know, there were Bobby Soxers who followed Frank Sinatra, and Elvis had, you know, a huge fan base and all that. But, you know, the teenager as a period, you know, certainly came into, you know, let's say, you know, maybe right before the war, but certainly the post-war period with the automobile and the
Yeah.
highway system, you know, the whole concept of the teenager with discretionary income and a subculture unto itself really did come, you know, I would say a little bit the silent generation, but you know, again, with the post-war prosperity, it really took, and the boom, which is why there were
Sure.
so many of us because of the prosperity and people were having kids again and feeling optimistic about the future. And so there was, you know, so our generation, we were certainly the first generation to be targeted by the media in the way we
Yeah.
were. You know, like I describe in the book, I talk about how they wanted us to be consumers rather than citizens. You know, when we started being citizens and making a, you know, expressing opinions, they didn't like that so much. They wanted us to just buy stuff. So the same way they sold us Etch-a-Sketch and Mr. Potato Head, I mean, the Beatles were marketed too to us. Is you know,
Yeah.
no question about
But
that.
the
There was a
thing is, the Beatle, the track that you talk about in your book. And you, and there's no way to emphasize this enough. I mean, there's no way to overstate this. The Beatles changed the politics of the nation, and they turned an entire generation from kind of a, well, kind of just going along into a counterculture in direct opposition to the mainstream.
Yes.
And they didn't just do it with one song. They did it with everything from the way they dressed to their attitude. And it wasn't just John Lennon at the end and Yoko Ono and the sort of more political stuff. It was from the very beginning. It was like, we saw ourselves as different than our parents, and it wasn't just age difference, it was generational. It was like, we're going to do differently than them. We're going to change the world. And of course, to get to a more serious subject, if you look at today's environmentalism, for instance, or anti-racism, or, you know, gender inclusiveness, or gay rights, or gay marriage, none of this happens with, you know, much as the boomers have a bad reputation in some ways, deserved or undeserved, this directly follows from the counterculture in the early 60s through to the present. That's where these movements all have their roots. Otherwise, none of this exists. And without the Beatles, you don't have a generation's self-awareness to be different. And your book is great about that. In all the stories you tell, it's just such an important thing. But I, you know, I'd like you to talk about that in some depth. Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. If you appreciate my cultural and political commentary, please do me a favor and subscribe to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. You can subscribe for free, or you can kick in a couple of dollars a month and help me out and help me keep this going if you're able. Either way, I'm incredibly grateful for your support and most of all for your participation. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy as we move toward November of 2024. And every subscription helps create, build, sustain, and put voice to this movement for truth. Thank you so much.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, to play devil's advocate for a moment, you know, people say, well, you know, you can't credit the Beatles with everything. But I am inclined to agree with you, but I want to mention something about Bob Dylan. Because he was, you know, also a countercultural voice, even before the Beatles came on the scene, and was obviously very overtly political from the beginning. But he did not have the megaphone that the Beatles had. You know, the Beatles cut across, again, this huge swath of the population. And that's part of where their power to be agents of change came from, because... Again, I was 7. You were, what, 10, whatever.
13 or 12 or 10 or whatever.
But, you know, college students talk about, you know, their impact. So it was really across the, you know, the boom, you know, the whole 18-year age range, really, of boomers were, you know, I mean, in the book, I interview people born between 46 and 61.
Yeah, and I was born in 52, so I'm right in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, those of us who were right in the middle, I think maybe were in some sense most profoundly affected by them, because we were not fully formed yet as people. So, and because they were such a presence when we were, you know, developing our identities and learning about the social world and relationships and love and romance and feelings and all these things that they talk about so beautifully.
Yeah.
Music, it, you know, it was very impactful, but the you know, their impact on the culture, you know, I don't think, you know, I mean, I've been accused of like over, you know, attributing too much to them, like I'm too Beatles-centric. You know, it's who knows, you know, but I think that, you know, they arrived at the right moment.
Yeah,
I think there was a lot of cognitive, what I call cognitive dissonance in the culture at you know, during the Kennedy era, you know, the SDS was already formed at that time, the Port Huron Statement, which if you read certain passages of it, reads like a hippie manifesto, right?
Yeah.
So this stuff was in the air, you know, the, and I talk in the book about, you know, the what are called, were called the sick comedians, you know, the comedians like Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul, who were talking about, you know, being a little countercultural in their way. So the moment was really opportune for them and the huge demographic.
Yeah.
So, and the prosperity, you know, so and just a and Kennedy too contributed to that vibe of the kind of forward looking progress, all that, you know.
The thing is that the Beatles did differently, and then I got to reintroduce you here for people who are just jumping in. But and so let me do this, and then, because I'll forget otherwise, and then I'm going to reintroduce you. And then please remember what I just said and jump back in. I think the uniqueness of the Beatles was that they were such a big deal, and they spoke to social issues directly and obliquely in such a way that the young people being influenced by them saw, we saw ourselves as their people. And there were hundreds of millions of us, and there were more of us than there were of, quote, them. We were on the ascendant.
Right.
And I think that translated into something no one else has ever done in pop music. or rock and roll, or jazz for that matter. They were so big and they were such a big deal that they made pop music and the cultural phenomena that went with it a huge force in and of itself, whereas it hadn't been before. You don't think of Elvis and Frank Sinatra as unleashing a massive societal force that
Exactly.
then made all the other music more and more important. So without the Beatles, the
I
Rolling
think
Stones are not as important, and what they write about is not as important. Without the Beatles, Bob Dylan is not as important because they made the entire genre bigger. They made
well,
it into a
they opened
global phenomenon.
everybody. They opened everybody's ears. You
Yeah.
know, they opened everybody's ears to what music could be. I think of it as a renaissance, that they
Well,
kind of
and to the
started a renaissance.
possibility that it can be a huge thing.
Right. I mean, there was always folk music, you know, there was Woody Guthrie and that. But again, the mass appeal, you know,
Yeah.
the size of our demographic and the readiness and willingness of the media to jump on because they saw
Yeah.
money in it. I mean, don't forget, like shortly after the Beatles, you have Shindig goes on the air,
Yeah.
Hullabaloo goes on the air, you know, so there, and you know, these teen magazines. So there was, and of course, all the Beatles merchandise. So you know, there it became kind of like a very symbiotic thing in the culture where they just kind of got bigger and bigger. And you know, and of course, over the course of their development as artists, the fact that they were so powerful and popular, that gave them bought them their freedom to
Yeah.
say, leave us alone in the studio, let us do this, let us, you know, let us not to leave us alone, but like let us experiment
Sure.
with George Martin, let us do, you know, so they grew as artists. You know, they had the freedom to do that. Of course, we should also mention the drugs had something to do with it as well,
But
in terms.
another little thing, and then I do want to reintroduce you, is that from the British point of view, where I was in school there, one thing the Beatles did there that they didn't do as much here because it wasn't such an issue, is they played an enormous role in smashing the class barriers in Britain.
Yes.
Because in Britain, it's all the aristocracy and all these people, landed gentry and the landowners and the royalty and all the rest. And all of a sudden, the Beatles are bigger than these guys, and they don't necessarily have the right accents. They're making more money. They're a global phenomena. The Queen has to, in the end, give them some sort of an award,
Right.
but she's playing catch up because they're the big deal. And then they make swinging London a thing. Anyway,
Yes.
let me reintroduce you. This is In Conversation with Frank Schaefer. I'm Frank Schaefer. My guest today is sociologist and author Candy Leonard, who's one of my favorite people because she's written one of my favorite books, and it's our book club offering. It has to be read here in April. And 2/24 marks the 10th anniversary of the publication of Candy's excellent book, Beatleness: How the Beatles and Their Fans Remade the World. And Beatleness is our has to be read title for the month of April, and we will link to everything and so forth. Candy's work includes a transformative vision for the senior housing for senior housing called Project Blackbird, as well as consulting on the design and marketing of products and services for boomer women to enhance quality of life and produce and reduce harm on the planet. So Candy does a lot of stuff. Please subscribe to In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, of which this is one episode, on Apple Podcasts, and also to my Substack. It has to be said, at frankschaefer.substack.com. Please subscribe to that. And back to Candy Leonard and her book Beatleness. And as we've been trying to say here, and people of my age will get this, there's been nothing quite like the impact the Beatles had before, since, because other bands had a huge impact. Bob Dylan, other people commented on the culture and helped change it, and the Vietnam War and all the rest of it. But I think I'm safe in saying this categorically: no one made music, contemporary music, a bigger deal than the Beatles, which then rubbed off on a lot of other people who got taken much more seriously. And one thing you do brilliantly in your book is show how they were kind of, they weren't taken seriously. They'll be gone by May. They released an album. They're just another pop phenomena. And then all of a sudden, the media had to come back and eat humble pie, because not only did these guys outlast everything and they were huge, they began to change the culture. And by the end, the writing about the Beatles in the press is serious contemplative writing by people trying to figure out what it is about our society they've changed. So they're taken completely unseriously at the beginning, and they're just a one, you know, they're going to have a hit and then they'll be gone. And then by the end, you know, here we are 60 years later trying to figure out what they did to our culture, and they still resonate through everything. And every musician that's ever sold a song can thank the Beatles for making music a bigger deal than it would have been, whether they've been influenced or not. I don't think that's an overstatement. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I you know, you point out how at the beginning they weren't taken seriously. I mean, part of it, you know, the press, I think, you know, thought, you know, the hair was just a gimmick, whatever. But part of the reason they weren't taken seriously is because they had a lot of young female fans.
Sure.
And so there's just, oh, little girls like them, teenage girls like them. And that, you know, the sort of the misogyny of the press. And you can see this in some of the early reviews and commentary about them, was really very disparaging comments about their young fans. And I think with Rubber Soul was really where, well, of course, A Hard Day's Night, which again, it's hard to believe is a 60-year-old movie in the summer. But, you know, the reviews of A Hard Day's Night in The New Yorker and The New York Times and all the publications of the day are very interesting, because they all kind of, gee, I went in there, I kind of had to go see this movie. And like, I was, you know, they were all blown away at how great it was. So they started to be taken seriously somewhat with A Hard Day's Night. But then at the, in December of 65, when Rubber Soul comes out, which was really a thing apart. I mean, it was so artistically ahead of even, you know, of this beautiful stuff they were doing in Help, which itself was ahead of the early He Loves You type stuff. So that's with Revolver, they really started being taken much more seriously as artists, for sure.
Well, and as a political cultural force that is turning all these young people into something else that is unrecognizable to their parents, a completely different set of values, whether it was about sexuality or the music itself or drugs or just an attitude toward race.
The lyrics on Rubber Soul are much more sophisticated than anything that came before. And that, you know, there's references to, you know, even Help, like, you know, she said that living with me was bringing me, you know, there were these little things that were put out suggesting a more, you know, like a kind of a liberation that was brought to relationships. But I have to give the Rolling Stones some credit here too. The summer of 65, Satisfaction comes out. Now, you could argue that wouldn't have happened without the Beatles. All right, that's a whole other conversation. But that was huge, because that was really a hugely groundbreaking you know, song about, it was in effect a protest song, right, really. But it had a sexual aspect, it had an anti-consumer aspect, it had a, you know, it was really almost like a first punk song, you could almost say. And that was the summer of 65. So, you know, the Beatles sort of created an ecosystem of music and attitude being something different out there. Again, the huge number of young people who were consuming this.
And I think you bring up the misogyny aspect because of their fans being young women. And a lot of young men like me. But of course, that also ties into Taylor Swift, because she gets minimized by the press even today.
Yes.
Because of Swifties, quote unquote, who are generally seen as younger women. And of course, that's not true either, but that's how they're seen. And on top of that, obviously, she's a woman, a female entertainer. And so, you know, here we are 60 years later, the misogyny has lasted. It hasn't changed. And of course, just to change the subject slightly, you know, some of the sins of the rock and roll industry, you know, I think I mentioned this to you before, but one of my first paying jobs as a kid when I was I forget my age, 17, 16, 17, was helping with the light show at a disco called the Strobe Club in Montreux, Switzerland, one of the first. And we did the light show for the first appearance of the Led Zeppelin at the Montreux Jazz Festival. But if you look at the music of the Zeppelin today in the light of the Me Too movement and so forth, and what they were doing with their young fans who would come see them in the sort of line of what you see in Almost Famous, where the roadies are trading a young woman for a case of beer between each other. These from the point from today's point of view and from my point of view, at my age currently, these were not very good people when it
No.
came to how young women were treated. And of course, then when the Beatles have a fan base of young women, and then you fast forward 60 years to today, where Taylor Swift is diminished by these asshole misogynists who are still out there, like Andrew Tate and others, may not directly talk about her, but that hasn't changed. And in a way, I think it's worse now than ever, because
Backlash now, yeah.
what's that?
I think there's a backlash to a lot of, a
Yeah.
lot of it seems worse. But since it's just like everybody's, oh, Taylor Swift and her breakup songs. Well, hello,
Yeah.
what have pop songs ever been
Have they
about
ever been?
if not breakups and heartbreak? When the Beatles were writing songs about heartbreak and all, nobody said, oh, they just date women so they have fodder for their next
Yeah.
hit. This is the stuff that people say about Taylor Swift. It's ridiculous,
Yeah, and of course, it's so stupid to minimize songs about relationships or poetry, because then art disappears. So do all of Shakespeare's plays, amongst other things. Let me change the subject a little bit. I went too quickly through your black your I got your book so in my head here. It's hard to go somewhere else. But I want to talk about Project Blackbird and the legacy of the boomer generation. Are they changing elder culture the way they change youth culture? I know it's a huge jump. We'll get back to the Beatles, but you do other things, and I want to talk about that.
Well, this is something that is very much a work in progress. It's kind of a nucleus of an idea that is still in formation. But it's funny that you asked me this because this I was watching this morning. I mean, I've just been horrified for months about what's going on in Gaza.
Yeah.
And I watched an interview this morning with two physicians that just got back from there, and it just moved me to action. And I mean, I wrote to my congressional delegation and blah blah blah. But I have often thought over the years, and even during the Trump era, and still,
Sure.
like, all those Beatle fans
Yeah.
who were and boomers who were so activated, who envisioned a better world. There's still time to step up,
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that, what Bill McKibben's doing with Third Act kind of captures some of that. But I think there's a lot of disillusionment in our generation. I think, there's a lot of wanting to retire and just, hang out and have fun with the grandchildren and play pickleball and kind of enjoy their golden years. But I don't know. I mean, I think that just imagine if
Yeah.
all the people who were protesting Vietnam or who attended the first Earth Day in April of 1970
Sure.
are equally activated today on behalf of their children and grandchildren, what we could accomplish.
What
So,
is just tell me the words Project Blackbird. What do they mean? What does this refer to?
well, as I said, it's still something I'm working on, but the song Blackbird, right? You're
Sure.
only waiting for this moment to arise. Like, there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah.
But it's also, I'll tell you how it first came to me. I was taking a course at MIT about the 100-year city and how cities are preparing for older adults,
Sure.
and all this. And we got in, and then so I learned a lot about the so-called senior housing industry, and I was just appalled at, what they're doing and how out of touch it is, and how they don't understand, like, how come boomers don't want to buy into our community? And it's like, so I just had this thought about alternatives to that. And I called it Project Blackbird, but I see, and this was a couple of years ago when I first started formulating these ideas, and But I see Project Blackbird as really broader than simply new ways of living in old
Sure.
age. And also intergenerationally. I mean, if we could, there are ways that we could develop new ways of living that are intergenerational, that address and that are also based on simplicity,
Yeah.
that will improve the health of everybody involved and caretaking. And it's sort of there's a sociological concept in sociology. Well, people talk about chosen family, whatever, called fictive kin. In other words, that you have people who are like family, but not necessarily your
Sure.
family, and that there's the relationship is like in family, where there's caretaking and living, sharing meals and all this kind of stuff. So it's sort of this vision that I have. It's as I say, it's still very much a work in progress. But Project Blackbird in general, I mean, I see it really as, our generation, and boomers get a lot of shit for like messing up the world. And let me comment on that for a minute, particularly regarding the environment. We
Yeah.
get a lot of blame for that. But if you really look back at energy policy in this country over the past 40 years, it's
Yeah.
really the World War II generation and the Cheneys and
Sure.
all those that and the fossil fuel people that really, boomers had nothing to do with that.
Yeah, it was not, this was not concocted at Woodstock.
Exactly. And further, all the things that millennials rightly complain about, the cost of housing, student debt, all of these issues that have come to the fore during the neoliberal era, this is not the fault of boomers.
Right,
Now,
right.
where we are at fault, I have to say, I mean, boomers did help Reagan get into the White House. That is true. Okay. And that's a problem. But the policies that have prevailed over the last 4 decades are not boomer policies. And if you even look at the White House, okay, so Clinton, who ended up being a huge disappointment, but he was the first boomer president, right? And if you remember all the shit he got, remember he smoked pot, he
Yeah.
wrote, right? So he had, I think what Clinton did was he swung more to the center because he wanted to silence all his critics because he
Sure,
was,
because he
we
was too much of a hippie.
have in the White House, so he kind of played all that down. And then we have Bush too, who is a boomer, but he surrounded himself with the World War II generation people that
Sure.
his father had, all
Yeah.
right? So we and then Obama, who is a late boomer, right? He's born in 61, but he also by that point was a little bit more centrist than like so we in some sense I feel like we never really had a boomer president in the
Well,
sense.
and yeah, and I agree, but another thing I would just add is let's not pretend that all boomers were, left of center Beatles fans
That's
either.
true.
I
That is
mean, we,
true.
we had our, Donald Trump has been put in the White House for various reasons, but one of them is that a bunch of boomer, but also younger white Republican voters jumped behind him. So that, I look at the Beatles influence and the Beatles generation, if you want to put it, I won't call it left wing, but it's to the liberal side of the spectrum, and that's how they change things. Woodstock was about that, the environmental movement that we began in the 60s and 70s, which continues to this day, we being that generation, was about that. The kind of people I was hanging out with who liked the Beatles were not the future Dick Cheney. They were not going to become, Enron and they were working for Standard Oil and all the rest of it. So what I'm trying to say is it's not as if we can say the left or the more enlightened people or the Beatle tribe dominated the boomers. There was a whole other movement that was burning the Beatles albums because, John Lennon said that they were more popular than Jesus. And by the way, given the fall off of religion in America, whatever one's view of that, he actually proved to be pretty true
Oh,
when it came to
absolutely.
that.
Well, they know he was right. That's why they reacted so strongly. He said that. But getting back to the fact that not all boomers were, let's say, left of center, that's true. I mean, as I said, the boomers helped elect Reagan. And of course, many boomers helped elect Trump, you know. But I think that, you know, between the Reagan years and, let's say, 2016, like, you know, the what I call the neoliberal miasma, you know, a lot of people got, you know, were burnt and pissed off. And the Democratic Party, you know, dropped the ball and did not, you know, just became very corporatist. And so a lot of things that happened, I think, over the years contributed to people becoming sort of pissed off and more right wing, if you will. You know, but all that, you know, I mean, when I think about, you know, how we got here, you know, from the 60s to now, I mean, I think the biggest tragedy was the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. Because had he won, which there's evidence to suggest he would have, and had he had a second term, okay, so he would have gotten out of Vietnam. He would have addressed a lot of issues that are, you know, like we would be a lot further along in being a more egalitarian, a fairer country. We wouldn't
Well,
have had.
between the two Kennedy assassinations and Martin Luther King, we had a whole movement was stillborn.
Right. I mean, we wouldn't have had Watergate and all the cynicism and mistrust of government and all the bullshit that followed from Watergate. I mean, I think that, yeah, of course, I mean, all right, well, none of, you know, it's like, okay, if, I mean, it's sad that that didn't happen, but you know, there is a, I think, I don't know, getting back to our generation and the fact that there's still unfinished work. I mean, you know, there's so many problems out there. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, you have grandchildren, I have grandchildren. I mean, a lot of people in our generations do. And, you know, there's needless to say, you know, a lot of concern about the world that they're going to be inheriting, not only in terms of climate, but in terms of the political climate. I want my kids to grow up in a democracy.
Yeah, me too. And speaking of which, you know, you're talking about this kind of odd view of quote retirement. You know, it seems to me we would all do better if we did what I am luckily doing. It's not by virtue, it's by the way things fell out. But, you know, I live near my grandchildren. I see them all the time and I help in their childcare. There's a couple of them upstairs right now with my wife, Jeannie. We're teaching them to play gin rummy. And but the fact of the matter is, I think a current catastrophe is the lack of intergenerational connection. And
Exactly.
every single study of this, even longevity for elderly and older people, do far better when they have regular interaction with younger people and especially grandchildren. And then, of course, kids' view of aging and fear of aging and even of death is completely changed by having a close relationship. I can't, you know, there's a lot of things I can imagine, Candy. One of them would maybe the thousandth thing on the list would be to take off to a retirement village far from where my family was. And I don't know what the hell I'd be doing there, you know, in wherever, Florida or something else. But it just seems to me crazy that places that don't even allow people under the age 55 to live there exist as if somehow these are refuges from the
Yeah,
world.
it's crazy. It's unhealthy for everybody. And not, I mean, you know, the age segregation is a relatively new thing. People did not live like this.
No, crazy.
And it's not good for anybody because generations learn from each other in both directions.
Well, and did childcare for younger parents who were working? What do you think all the Italian farmers were doing through
Right.
the last 1,000 years? Grandma and grandpa helped with the kids while the younger generation of the wife and the husband were out in the fields doing stuff. I mean, that's what childcare always was. It's called grandparents.
Right. And same thing with elder care. You know,
Yeah,
people are living
exactly.
longer. There's a big crisis around this and how, you know, all this. And so it's, you know, we're not living the right way.
No. I mean, if it does take a village, someone killed the village.
Well, yeah,
Because
that's what
villages are intergenerational. That's the whole thing.
Right. So you see these ads for like retirement homes and, retirement communities where they're still building these ridiculously large houses, for people to live, it's just none of it. And that, the first thing they do, they clear away all the trees and they build these ugly houses that are based on this kind of mid-century sort of, or like really not even mid-century. It's like this kind of 80s. It's that it's just everything about it is so unappealing, and they don't understand why it is that some of these places have a hard time finding people. And then they say, oh well, boomers are into wellness, we'll focus on wellness. But it's a very superficial consumption oriented view of wellness, so yeah, I mean, I have a whole manifesto on this.
Well, we want to see that manifesto. Are you going to write a book on what we're talking about here? Because Blackbird, whatever, I'm just curious if you're working up something on that.
I don't know that it's going to necessarily be book length, but I am writing about it. I
Well,
am.
let
And
us know when you do.
I will, yeah. I
My
mean,
producer Ernie wants to know if you've heard Beyoncé's cover of Blackbird.
I have heard it. It's nice. It's
Yeah, I
nice.
haven't heard it.
It's nice. I mean, it's nice, and it's nice that she did it. It's a great song. I mean, it's a song of hue about. It's optimism and seizing the moment and, not being afraid to, I mean, this is, the Beatles were about that. We didn't get into this aspect, but they were very much about in some like self-actualization. They were about being who you are, just taking risks, taking chances to be who you are, and to, I mean, their early days, they got so much rejection, so much rejection, but they believed in what they were doing. And they had incredible persistence. And, they found angels to help them, Brian Epstein, George Martin, and they were able to do that. And I think one of the reasons young people are so intrigued with the story of the Beatles is because of that persistence. But anyway, but Blackbird, the song Blackbird and other songs too, but that song really captures that spirit, that optimism that they encapsulate.
I want to just tell people again, we've got the book Beatleness by Candy Leonard as our April book club. And this is sort of an odd way to plug a book, but I can't think of a book I've read that I've enjoyed more. I just got so much pleasure out of reading it, not just because it kind of reflected so accurately on my time, but that stories you pick to tell in the book about different people's first exposure to the Beatles, how it changed them, and then how they tracked with that. It's a brilliant piece of journalism as well as other things. I mean, it really, I don't think anybody could look at the Beatles or be interested in them or study them without going to your book at some point, because it's got everything in there. It's great. It's not just a fan book or something like that. It's a real analysis. You get the music, but you also get the impact. But then you tell the stories of the kind of people I know, like me and like many others. In other words, you represent each story represents thousands of people who experienced a similar thing, I think. And I lived it, so I kind of know about this. And I just highly recommend the book. I think it's, if you want to be entertained, take a deep breath and a time out from the 2024 election cycle and then come back in again, refreshed. Just get Candy's book and read it. I mean, Beatleness is a real pleasure. It's why my wife's given away 5 copies. I just need to plug it because I really like it. I want it to stay around.
I really appreciate that. It's very sad, as an author, it's just hugely satisfying to hear that. So
Yeah,
thank
it's sincerely meant. I mean, I love it. And I'm not surprised you keep hearing from people who feel similarly, entertained, but also informed. It's lovely. Speaking of which, have you gotten anything back from anybody who worked with the Beatles at some point, whether it was as a roadie or just personally out there with them, or people who were at those first concerts remembering some aspect? I'm sure you've gotten more information from people after the book came out, as in, hey, I've read this in this story and it reminds me of, and then whatever.
Well, I'll get, sometimes I'll get an email from someone who's read it, who, was at Shea Stadium, let's say, or who saw them, in the early days at the Cavern, so, which is, I mean, not, I haven't heard from any Beatles insiders yet anyway. But I do get, emails from people who, that it resonates, when they, from their own experience of not only, sitting in their bedroom listening or dancing with their friends, but also, people who had actually had the opportunity to see them. I think there's something like, the touring years, like how many over the touring years, how many people, there's like less than 2 million people got to see them live.
Yeah.
It's
Jeannie, by the way, saw them live twice, so she's part of that.
Wow.
My
Okay.
wife,
So,
Jeannie, yeah, in San Francisco.
yeah. So it's kind of an elite club, But what's interesting is that people who have seen them live talk about it as like a, one of the peak experiences of their lives,
Well, when I met Jeannie and she wanted to know if I had their new album, and of course I knew what she meant, and it was Abbey Road. And I had it downstairs and we met and married and have been together for 54 years now. You know, one of the things we talked about that night, which basically, and because she came over as a truthful person, I believed her. But, you know, I was growing up in Switzerland and I'd been in boarding school in Britain. And now I'm meeting this beautiful young woman who's seen the Beatles twice live recently, like, can talk about what it was like and where she was sitting. You know, I don't think it was the Fillmore West. I think it was at the Cow Palace in San Francisco, and she'd seen them twice. I mean, who sees the Beatles twice? You know, I'm watching Top of the Pops on the BBC in the UK. That's as close as I'm getting. And Jeannie's seen the Beatles twice. So she had this kind of sainted aura of having been touched by some sort of grace, as well as me having an instant crush on her. But, you know, I'll never forget it. I mean, I was talking to someone who had seen the Beatles, and that made a huge impression on me at that, and would have on you too. I mean, if you met, hey, yeah, I saw them twice. I mean, she just mentioned it.
There is this sense of like, people who meet Paul McCartney have, today have still have this feeling of like that there's something magical about it,
Hey,
that
Taylor Swift included. There was a story
that
out about how she got, you know, I mean, totally starstruck meeting him. And isn't it crazy how every 2 minutes there's another incredible in-depth documentary either analyzing their music or how Paul wrote or this, that, and the other. I mean, we haven't gone there, but in addition to your book, the longevity of the afterglow of the Beatles, it's like some comet, meteor comet tail. It just goes forever.
Well, getting back to our generation, so many changes in the world, good, bad, and otherwise in the world and in people's personal lives. But yet, the Beatles are a constant, okay? You can listen, go put on any Beatle record. It sounds just as good as it did the first time you heard it.
Absolutely.
They for our generation, they're like they're very grounding,
Yeah,
they're
absolutely.
constant in a way that's really very special.
Yeah, and unique. Yeah. You know right where you are with one bar of music.
I mean, it was really a singular event. I mean, it really was. And we, those of us who grew up during that and experienced it and were engaged with it, it leaves a mark,
Yeah.
and of course we pass that down to our children and grandchildren, which contributes to their longevity. And of course, anybody who loves music, like you have to at least know about the Beatles. You don't have to love them necessarily, but like, they're a centerpiece,
Well, I will end this by reminding people I'm talking to Candy Leonard, and her book, Beatleness, is a favorite of mine, and we've made it a book club offering, and it has to be read. And I'll just finish with this and then say goodbye. When I read your book, and I know this sounds like hyperbole and a little bit bullshitty, but I mean it sincerely, as someone who loves the Beatles, I got that same pleasure that I can remember when I opened a new Beatles album and would slit the cellophane wrapper, take the album, take Rubber Soul out on vinyl, stick it on my record player, and I can remember what it was like to drop the needle on this absolutely pristine, clean album and then just sit back and listen. and then listen again. And when you crack open your book, Beatleness, and dive in, that's the level of pleasure that is there
Oh
waiting
my
for
God.
readers.
I don't know what to say. That's such high praise. I
Yeah, I
mean,
mean
I
it.
really appreciate
Yeah,
that.
I just love your work and I love the book. So thanks so much for doing it.
Well, thank you.
Jeannie sends you her love as a great fan of yours who saw the Beatles twice and relived everything. But it is the pleasure of reading the book is like listening to an album. It's fabulous. It's just a good, it's a good piece of work. And I think it'll be around a long time because the Beatles will too. People will always want to get to know them better. And there's no better path than reading Beatleness. It's a great book.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. And it's been great talking to you again. And we're
Yes.
making this a book club offering. So, and if there's anything you do in the future that will interest us, please tell Ernie because you've got fans here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
I'll
Candy.
Be in touch. Take care.
In Conversation with Frank Schaefer is a production of the George Bailey Morality and Public Life Fellowship. It is produced by Ernie Gregg and hosted by Frank Schaefer, author of Fall in Love, Have Children, Stay Put, Save the Planet, Be Happy, a post-pandemic blueprint for rebalancing work and family in favor of love and living. To learn more and support the show, please visit lovechildrenplanet.com.